don't, and B, because living requires effort and ingenuity, though this is also true of games as distinct from fights. So far as we know, animals do not live in constant anxiety about sickness and death, as we do, because they live in the present. Nevertheless, they will fight when in hunger or when attacked. We must, however, be careful of taking animals as models of perfectly natural behavior. If natural means good or wise, human beings can improve on animals, though they do not always do so. But human beings, especially in Western civilization, make death the great bogey. This has something to do with the popular Christian belief that death will be followed by the dread Last Judgment, when sinners will be consigned to the temporary horrors of purgatory or the everlasting agony of hell. More usual today is the fear that death will take us into everlasting nothingness, as if that could be some sort of experience, like being buried alive forever. No more friends, no more sunlight and birdsong, no more love or laughter, no more ocean and stars, only darkness without end. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Imagination cannot grasp simple nothingness, and must therefore fill the void with fantasies, as in experiments with sensory deprivation, where subjects are suspended weightlessly in sound and light-proof rooms. When death is considered the final victory of black over white in the deadly serious battle of white must win, the fantasies which fill the void are largely ghoulish. Even our popular fantasies of heaven are on the grim side, because the usual image of God is of a very serious and awesome grandfather enthroned in a colossal church. And, of course, in church one may decorously rejoice, but not have real rip-roaring fun. Oh, what their joy and their glory must be, those endless Sabbaths the blessed ones see. Who wants to be stuck in church wearing a surplice and singing Alleluia forever? Of course, the images are strictly symbolic, but we all know how children feel about the old-time Protestant Sabbath and God's good book bound in black with its terrible typography. Intelligent Christians outgrow this bad imagery, but in childhood it has seeped into the unconscious and it continues to contaminate our feelings about death. Individual feelings about death are conditioned by social attitudes, and it is doubtful that there is any one natural and inborn emotion connected with dying. For example, it used to be thought that childbirth should be painful, as a punishment for original sin, or for having had so much fun conceiving the baby. For God had said to Eve and all her daughters, "In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children." Thus, when everyone believed that in having a baby it was a woman's duty to suffer, women did their duty, and many still do. We were much surprised, therefore, to find women in primitive societies who could just squat down and give birth while working in the fields, bite the umbilical cord, wrap up the baby, and go their way. It wasn't that their women were tougher than ours, but just that they had a different attitude. For our own gynecologists have recently discovered that many women can be conditioned psychologically for natural and painless childbirth. The pains of labor are renamed tensions, and the mother-to-be is given preparatory exercises in relaxing to tension and cooperating with it. Birth, they are told, is not a sickness. One goes to a hospital just in case anything should go wrong, though many avant-garde gynecologists will let their patients give birth at home. Premature death may come as a result of sickness, but, like birth, death as such is not a sickness at all. It is the natural and necessary end of human life, as natural as leaves falling in the autumn. Perpetual leaves are, as we know, made of plastic, and there may come a time when surgeons will be able to replace all our organs with plastic substitutes so that you will achieve immortality by becoming a plastic model of yourself. Physicians should therefore explore the possibility of treating death and its pangs as they have treated labor and its pains. Death is, after all, a great event. So long as it is not imminent, we cling to ourselves and our lives in chronic anxiety, however pushed into the back of the mind. But when the time comes where clinging is no longer of the least avail, the circumstances are ideal for letting go of oneself completely. When this happens, the individual is released from his ego prison, In the normal course of events, this is the golden opportunity for awakening into the knowledge that one's actual self is the self which plays the universe, an occasion for great rejoicing. But as customs now prevail, doctors, nurses, and relatives come around with smiling masks, assuring the patient that he will soon get over it, and that next week, or next month, he will be back home or taking a vacation by the sea. Worse still, physicians have neither the role nor the training for handling death. The Catholic priest is in a much better position. He usually knows just how to go about it, with no fumbling or humming and hawing. But the physician is supposed to put off death at all costs, including the life savings of the patient and his family. Ananda Kumaraswamy once said that he would rather die 10 years too early than 10 minutes too late. Too late and too decrepit or drugged to seize the opportunity to let oneself go, to lay me down with a will. I pray, he used to say, that death will not come and catch me unannihilate. That is, before I have let go of myself. This is why G.I. Gurdjieff, that marvelous rascal sage, wrote in his All and Everything, "The sole means now for the saving of the beings of the planet Earth would be to implant again into their presences a new organ, of such properties that every one of these unfortunates, during the process of existence, should constantly sense and be cognizant of the inevitability of his own death, as well as the death of everyone upon whom his eyes or attention rests. Only such a sensation and such a cognizance can now destroy the egoism completely crystallized in them." As we now regard death, this reads like a prescription for a nightmare. But the constant awareness of death shows the world to be as flowing and diaphanous as the filmy patterns of blue smoke in the air, that there really is nothing to clutch and no one to clutch it. This is depressing only so long as there remains a notion that there might be some way of fixing it, of putting it off just once more, or hoping that one has, or is, some kind of ego soul that will survive bodily dissolution. I am not saying that there is no personal continuity beyond death, only that believing in it keeps us in bondage. This is no more saying that we ought not to fear death than I was saying that we ought to be unselfish. Suppressing the fear of death makes it all the stronger. The point is only to know, beyond any shadow of doubt, that I and all other things now present will vanish, until this knowledge compels you to release them. To know it now, as surely as if you had just fallen off the rim of the Grand Canyon. Indeed, you were kicked off the edge of a precipice when you were born, and it's no help to cling to the rocks falling with you. If you are afraid of death, be afraid. The point is to get with it, to let it take over. Fear, ghosts, pains, transience, dissolution, and all. And then comes the hitherto unbelievable surprise. You don't die because you were never born. You had just forgotten who you are. All this comes much more easily with the collaboration of friends. When we are children, our other selves, our families, friends, and teachers do everything possible to confirm us in the illusion of separateness, to help us to be genuine fakes, which is precisely what is meant by being a real person. For the person, from the Latin persona, was originally the megaphone-mouthed mask used by actors in the open-air theatres of ancient Greece and Rome, the mask through, per, which the sound, sonus, came. In death, we doff the persona, as actors take off their masks and costumes in the green room behind the scenes. And just as their friends come behind the stage to congratulate them on the performance, so one's own friends should gather at the deathbed to help one out of one's mortal role, to applaud the show, and even more, to celebrate with champagne or sacraments, according to taste, the great awakening of death. There are many other ways in which the game of black and white is switched into the game of white must win, and like the battle for survival, they depend upon ignoring or screening out of consciousness the interdependence of the two sides. In a curious way, this is, of course, part of the game of black and white itself, because forgetting or ignoring their interdependence is hide in the game of hide and seek. Hide and seek is, in turn, the game of black and white. By way of illustration, we can take an excursion into an aspect of science fiction which is very rapidly becoming science fact. Applied science may be considered as the game of order versus chance, or order versus randomness, especially in the domain of cybernetics, the science of automatic control. By means of scientific prediction and its technical applications, we are trying to gain maximum control over our surroundings and ourselves. In medicine, communications, industrial production, transportation, finance, commerce, housing, education, psychiatry, criminology, and law, we are trying to make foolproof systems to get rid of the possibility of mistakes. The more powerful technology becomes, the more urgent the need for such controls, as in the safety precautions taken for jet aircraft, and, most interesting of all, the consultations between technicians of the atomic powers to be sure that no one can press the button by mistake. The use of powerful instruments, with their vast potentialities for changing man and his environment, requires more and more legislation, licensing and policing, and thus more and more complex procedures for inspection and keeping records. Great universities, for example, have vice presidents in charge of relations with the government and large staffs of secretaries to keep up with the mountains of paperwork involved. At times, the paperwork, recording what has been done, seems to become more important than what it records. Students' records in the registrar's office are often kept in safes and vaults, but not so the books in the library, unless extremely rare or dangerous. So, too, the administration building becomes the largest and most impressive structure on the campus, and faculty members find that more and more of their time for teaching and research must be devoted to committee meetings and form-filling to take care of the mere mechanics of running the institution. For the same reasons, it is ever more difficult to operate a small business which cannot afford to take care of the financial and legal red tape which the simplest enterprises must now respect. The ease of communication through such mass media as television, radio, books, and periodicals enables a single articulate individual to reach millions. Yet the telephone and the post office enable a formidable fraction of those millions to talk back, which can be flattering and pleasing, except that there is no way of giving individual replies, especially when correspondents seek advice for personal or specialized problems. Only the president or the prime minister or the heads of huge corporations can afford the staff and machinery to cope with so much feedback. The speed and efficiency of transportation by superhighway and air in many ways restricts freedom of travel. It is increasingly difficult to take a walk, except in such reservations for wanderers as state parks. But the nearest state park to my home has, at its entrance, a fence plastered with a long line of placards saying, "No fires, no dogs, no hunting, no camping, smoking prohibited, no horse riding, no swimming, no washing." I never did get that one. Picnics restricted to designated areas. Miles of what used to be free and easy beaches are now state parks, which close at 6 p.m., so that one can no longer camp there for a moonlight feast. Nor can one swim outside a 100-yard span watched by a guard, nor venture more than a few hundred feet into the water. All in the cause of safety first and foolproof living. Just try taking a stroll after dark in a nice American residential area. If you can penetrate the wire fences along the highways and then wander along a pleasant lane, you may well be challenged from a police car. Where are you going? Aimless strolling is suspicious and irrational. You are probably a vagrant or burglar. You are not even walking the dog. How much money are you carrying? Surely you could have afforded to take the bus, and if you have little or no cash, you are clearly a bum and a nuisance. Any competent housebreaker would approach his quarry in a Cadillac. Orderly travel now means going at the maximum speed for safety from point to point, but most reachable points are increasingly cluttered with people and parked cars, and so less worth going to see. And for similar reasons, it is ever more inconvenient to do business in the centres of our great cities. Real travel requires a maximum of unscheduled wandering, for there is no other way of discovering surprises and marvels, which, as I see it, is the only good reason for not staying at home. As already suggested, fast intercommunication between points is making all points the same point. Waikiki Beach is just a mongrelized version of Atlantic City, Brighton, and Miami. Despite the fact that more accidents happen in the home than elsewhere, increasing efficiency of communication and of controlling human behavior can, instead of liberating us into the air like birds, fix us to the ground like toadstools. All information will come in by super-realistic television and other electronic devices, as yet in the planning stage, or barely imagined. In one way, this will enable the individual to extend himself anywhere without moving his body, even to distant regions of space. But this will be a new kind of individual, an individual with a colossal external nervous system reaching out and out into infinity. And this electronic nervous system will be so interconnected that all individuals plugged in will tend to share the same thoughts, the same feelings, and the same experiences. There may be specialized types, just as there are specialized cells and organs in our bodies. For the tendency will be for all individuals to coalesce into a single bioelectronic body. Consider the astonishing means now being made for snooping, the devices already used in offices, factories, stores, and on various lines of communication, such as the mail and the telephone. Through the transistor and miniaturization techniques, these devices become ever more invisible and ever more sensitive to faint electrical impulses. The trend of all this is towards the end of individual privacy, to an extent where it may even be impossible to conceal one's thoughts. At the end of the line, no one is left with a mind of his own. There is just a vast and complex community mind, endowed, perhaps, with such fantastic powers of control and prediction that it will already know its own future for years and years to come. Yet the more surely and vividly you know the future, the more it makes sense to say that you've already had it. When the outcome of a game is certain, we call it quits and begin another. This is why many people object to having their fortunes told. Not that fortune-telling is mere superstition, or that the predictions would be horrible, but simply that the more surely the future is known, the less surprise and the less fun in living it. Let us indulge in one more fantasy along the same lines. Technology must attempt to keep a balance between human population and consumable resources. This will require, on the one hand, judicious birth control, and on the other, the development of many new types of food from earth, ocean, and air, doubtless including the reconversion of excrement into nutritious substances. Yet in any system of this kind, there is a gradual loss of energy. As resources dwindle, population must dwindle in proportion. If, by this time, the race feels itself to be a single mind-body, this super-individual will see itself getting smaller and smaller until the last mouth eats the last morsel. Yet it may also be that, long before that, people will be highly durable plastic replicas of people with no further need to eat. But won't this be the same thing as the death of the race, with nothing but empty plastic echoes of ourselves reverberating on through time? To most of us living today, all these fantasies of the future seem most objectionable. The loss of privacy and freedom, the restriction of travel, and the progressive conversion of flesh and blood, wood and stone, fruit and fish, sight and sound, into plastic, synthetic, and electronic reproductions. Increasingly, the artist and musician puts himself out of business through making ever more faithful and inexpensive reproductions of his original works. Is reproduction, in this sense, to replace biological reproduction through cellular fission or sexual union? In short, is the next step in evolution to be the transformation of man into nothing more than electronic patterns? All these eventualities may seem so remote as to be unworthy of concern. Yet in so many ways they are already with us, and as we have seen, the speed of technical and social change accelerates more than we like to admit. The popularity of science fiction attests to a very widespread fascination with such questions. And so much science fiction is in fact a commentary on the present, since one of the best ways of understanding what goes on today is to extend it into tomorrow. What is the difference between what is happening, on the one hand, and the direction of its motion, on the other?